So thanks very much for the invitation to come talk. So this is work with Martin Enneberg and Josh LePan. These guys are students at Harvard that I've been working with for a while. We have a first paper sort of summarizing some of the main results. And another couple which should be coming out soon. So a very natural starting ground for thinking about 4D physics and getting 4D physics from string theory is to compactify on a Calabi-Yau manifold. This is one of the earliest things you do. This is extremely well-studied territory. We've got powerful microscopic descriptions, world sheet descriptions. We've got nice space-time descriptions. We know a lot about the geometry and the topology of these manifolds. And that's important because the geometry and the topology control the four-dimensional physics you get at the end of the day. So an unfortunate fact about Calabi-Yau compactifications is that Calabi-Yaus have moduli spaces. This is roughly the shapes and size of the various cycles in the six-dimensional manifold. And these moduli correspond to massless scalars in the 4D theory, which is a total phenomenological disaster. So from the very beginning in studying string compactifications, a natural problem is to rid ourselves of these moduli. So one way to rid ourselves of the moduli is to turn on fluxes. So the fluxes are going to put some potential. The flux provides an energy density. The total energy depends on the size and the shape of the manifold. And that tends to, and if you choose fluxes cleverly, you can stabilize the size and shape of the manifold. And this corresponds to, in the 4D effective theory, to introducing a scalar potential, which lifts all the moduli. So the past few years have seen a huge explosion in work along these lines. And most of the constructions begin at the level of supergravity. You do a supergravity analysis, you calculate the potential, you check that there is a minimum of the potential where all the scalars take values that are self-consistent with the supergravity analysis. So you try to fix the coupling constants to small values around the minima. And these all start, or generically start, with a fiducial Calabi-Yau. You start with some geometry you know well and for which you have tools to calculate things like Yukawa couplings and numbers of generations, etc. So it would be nice to have a microscopic description of these flux vacua. But in general, in type 2 compactifications, for example, we turn on NSNS fluxes, we turn on Ramond-Ramond fluxes, non-perturbative effects, and most of these features of the compactification aren't amenable to a world sheet description or to a microscopic description. So while we have a good supergravity description that looks pretty reliable, we don't generally have microscopic control, which means we can't compute things. Right, that's the sort of crucial thing. There are a lot of quantities you might want to know where you can't compute them. And if you wanted to be really hard-nosed, you could say, look, we don't know that these vacua exist because we have an effective field theory description for something which involves all sorts of stringy effects in very crucial ways. We don't really have a microscopic description. That's not my attitude, but you could take a very hard-nosed attitude. So what I'd like to do is build you some examples of microscopic descriptions of flux vacua, very special kinds of flux vacua. Not all the moduli will be stabilized, but we're going to do it in a way that's, you'll see the degree to which it's useful. So a crucial hint, say, what the right way to go is, at least some Ramond-Ramond vacua, flux vacua, are dual to heterotic compactifications, where all the effects that stabilize moduli are amenable to world sheet analysis. There's NSNS flux. There's some heterotic gauge bundle with some instanton numbers. And we can study all that on the world sheet, at least in principle. More generally, you could just ask the question, in the heterotic string theory, you can turn on a bunch of fluxes, NSNS and gauge, and study lifting of Kähler moduli, or for that matter, complex, by tuning the fluxes of the gauge and NSNS sector. So that's the question I really want to address. I want to build you microscopic descriptions of these world sheet theories. So there's a certain conservation of difficulty at work. It's true there's no RR flux in these heterotic compactifications. There just aren't RR fluxes. There aren't D-brains. But there's still NSNS flux, our NSNS3 form, which I'll call H. And in particular, H can be expressed. This is comes from a Suzy variation. So space-time Suzy variation, so requiring that the space-time preserves n equals 1. Oh, I should say, we all want to break space-time Suzy to 0. I'm going to start with an n equals 1 compactification because it's an easy starting point. We can talk about breaking to zero supersymmetry, but just like with Calabi-Yau compactifications, I'm going to start with the easiest thing to do, which is go to n equals 1, which is already phenomenologically interesting, or might be phenomenological. So here, H is the NSNS3 form, and J is the 2 form on the compactification manifold. It's just the metric. It's the Hermitian 2 form. I'll talk about this in much more detail, but just quickly, if we have non-zero NSNS flux, if we have non-zero H, then J necessarily is not annihilated by the derivatives, which means that this is not Kähler. So the compactifications I'm going to be studying are non-Kähler compactifications. That's already a hard thing because we don't have all the powerful tools, Hodge theory, yada yada, to study these manifolds. Rather more dramatic is the Bianchi identity, which receives, thanks to Green and Schwartz, a one-loop correction. It's a differential equation. It's a really horrible differential equation from a geometer standpoint, because this scale tells us that the two sides scale inhomogeneously with the global conformal mode of the metric. This scales like the metric. This scales like a bunch of powers of the metric. And it's kind of hidden in the connection here because I've chosen a Hermitian connection on the gauge bundle. So if you have a non-trivial solution to this equation where both sides are non-zero, then the global conformal mode of the manifold is fixed. Okay. So we don't have a large radius limit. A non-trivial solution to this equation does not have a good large radius limit where you can study supergravity.
Now, can I ask a question?
Go. Yeah.
If you take 0-2 models on Kähler spaces,
yeah.
You could a priori make the same argument. R by R and F by F don't cancel pointwise.
Yeah.
But there, a space-time macroscopic argument gives you this rescaling anyway.
Absolutely.
So here, it's somehow crucially different. You don't have the axion shift symmetry.
Good. So here I'm going to have a non-trivial, so good. At the classical level. So you can ask about what are higher corrections. This equation gets corrections at higher order in alpha prime. This equation does not. It's an anomaly equation. So it's true that there are going to be higher corrections to this equation which allow us to have Kähler and still some H flux. But it's going to be H flux that compensates for certain local non-cancellations. This is going to, a solution of this form is different, is qualitatively different. In particular, we're going to have manifolds where the Chern classes don't cancel. So we'll come back to that in more detail. So it's kind of entertaining that, you know, these equations were first written down, you know, more than 20 years ago. And it's only very recently, and Strominger put a particularly nice geometric interpretation to the one-loop Suzy conditions. It's only in the past couple of years that proof of the existence of any solution to this equation has appeared. In particular, Fu and Yao did a very beautiful piece of work. I'll review that in more detail in a few minutes.
But non-trivial,
right, non-trivial. Right, there are certainly solutions with H equals 0. They're Calabi-Yaus, right? So we want a non-trivial solution. So right off the bat, since there's no large radius limit, we're not going to be able to write down a nonlinear sigma model and have sort of casual confidence that it's well-behaved, because we don't have a large radius limit about which to do conformal perturbation theory. So we're going to have to build a conformal field theory directly. Okay, so that's going to be the goal. But we do have this one-loop effective geometry, and that's going to be a guide. So our basic strategy is going to be very similar to the Calabi-Yau case, where we have gauge linear sigma models for Calabi-Yau compactifications. So what we're going to do is we're going to build an n equals 2 gauge theory in 2D. So this is just a massive theory, which flows down the RG to an n equals 2 CFT. Such that the one loop geometry solves these equations, and in particular the one loop exact anomaly equation. So we're going to want to see this geometric structure manifest, Hermitian manifold, and all the conditions for n equals 1 Suzy at the one loop level. We're going to want to see that this equation, the Bianchi identity, is solved in a way that doesn't get corrections at higher orders in perturbation theory. And we're going to want to see that there are corrections to these metric statements. Okay. So why would you bother building a gauge theory? There are a couple of reasons to do it. One, it's always nice to add extra degrees of freedom and linearize. But another thing is that in 2D, in specific, gauge theory is supernormalizable. The gauge coupling just is dimensionful. That means that if I can identify RG invariants, I can just compute them in the UV where the theory is free and run down to the IR. This is the sort of thing you can do for Yukawa couplings. In a Clavial, this is a powerful way to compute Yukawa couplings because we can identify them as certain chiral objects in the n equals 2 theory, identify them in the UV, compute them, and let the RG flow do what it does. Good. These are going to, when I say n equals 2, excellent question. So these are heterotic. These are going to be 0-2. Okay? But importantly, a 0-2 supersymmetry is still a huge amount of supersymmetry in two dimensions. You have a superpotential which is not renormalized. You have a full chiral structure. There's a topological ring which computes things like OPEs, which computes things like the Yukawa couplings. And you can isolate those topological quantities through a twist.
No, I'm not asking about this. There are torsionful things which are 2-2.
Absolutely. So the interesting solutions to this are going to be 0-2. Along the way, we're going to build some 2-2 models. So we'll see where the connection comes in there. An interesting sort of a liminal case is the 1-2 context. If you have a 2-2 theory, you can still have anomalies showing up because you can lose some of the structure of your gauge theory. I'm not going to have a lot to say about this, but if anyone wants to talk about 1-2, I can tell you what little I know about the 1-2.
Is geometry special for 1-2?
The geometry appears to be somewhat special, yeah. So it's more general than the 2-2 case. But the nice thing about 1-2 is that there's still the 1, and in type 2, we've gauged a 1-1 current. So when we couple to a type 2 world sheet gravity, we're going to need the 1, okay? So this can't be a type 2 compactification. This can. Okay. So the upshot is we're going to try to build a computationally effective description of these geometries. Okay, questions on the sort of broad goals? Okay, so I'm going to start off with a discussion of just n equals 1 heterotic vacua. What did we know? You know, what's the geometric story? Then I'm going to walk through the construction of geometries with NSNS3-form flux, with H-flux turned on, starting with type 2 or 2-2 compactifications, and then show you what special things happen in the 0-2 case, where this shows up.
Actually, let me ask a question before you go on.
Sure.
The Fu-Yao constructive solution,
yeah.
How do they know it's a solution given that it's some string scale space?
They don't.
Part of the point of these things is usually first to just establish there is a CFT.
That's exactly right. So they don't. So here's the statement. The statement is, okay, I have supergravity, and I have the one-loop anomaly equation, and you know all the Dilatino, Gaugino variations, all that.
Is there some Susie argument that
no.
extends to that it's enough to guarantee a solution?
Absolutely not. In fact, let me say more about that. In the Clavial case, even, it's already a subtle point. So in Clavial, we have, of course, that the manifold is at one loop for each E flat. So we have, okay, that's great. Except, you know, string theory, scattering is not the same as scattering in gravity. It's soft. Graviton scattering is soft, which means that the effective action can't just be root GR. It has to have corrections. So you read off the Veneziano amplitude. What's the first correction? There's an R to the fourth correction. OK, great. Does that R to the fourth correction vanish for Ricci flat manifolds? No. So it's this horrible contraction of four Riemann tensors with some indices up here. And this does not vanish for Ricci flat manifolds.
No,
No, this is separate from the axion. This is separate. This is just directly at the level of alpha prime corrections. So how do you know that this goes away? This goes away only because it's Kähler. When you impose Kähler, you can just show on a group theory argument that the manifold being Ricci flat and Kähler automatically has R to the fourth being zero. Then you show another thing. So Gross and Witten pointed this out, and then Sen and Emachemsky, both I think in 86, that you can write all the higher order alpha prime terms in the effective action in terms of R times some horrible contraction, some horrible X of R, plus the R to the fourth term, which they just call Y, times some X tilde, again, of R. So the index structure, just on group theory grounds, based on SO8 group theory, is always of the form R times some horrible tensor plus Y times some horrible tensor. So if both of these vanish, all the higher order corrections vanish. This vanishes from the tree level action. For Kähler manifold, this is zero. For non-Kähler manifold, it's not known. So an interesting question, and this is sort of a side issue which I can discuss afterwards if anyone's interested, is decomposing this in terms of the torsion invariance of the manifold. So you'd like to see, okay, if it's not Kähler, if it's just some like half-flat manifold, how do you know that this vanishes? That's an interesting question already.
There is some axiom says that you can't get powers of the Kähler moduli.
There's a Maxwell argument that you can get a solution starting off of the tree.
Yeah, that's right. Right, no, absolutely. So this is sort of a field, but the question is just whether there's any potential generated for these flat guys, right?
Well, you don't have to go this far afield.
Yeah, okay, so maybe we can come back to that afterwards. But I think this is already an interesting question which hasn't been tackled anywhere, so if anyone wants to throw their weight into it.
The question, what's the small parameter that makes you care about the one-loop geometry?
Okay, good. So there is a flux. Good. H is gonna, at the end of the day, there's going to be a flux number corresponding to H. So we're going to be able to get a few times.
So for large flux, the relevant volume scales like the flux or something?
For foo, yeah, they're a finite number. So flux can't be dialed arbitrarily large. It can be dialed to 10. It can't be dialed to 1,000. So, you can kind of believe. The other thing is that the hard part in Fu Yao is not solving equations like this. These are just stupid PDEs, which, you know, they're linear, they're well-behaved, no problem. This is hard. It's nonlinear, and you have to prove the existence of, at the end of the day, you write J is equal to some sort of dilaton on the compact manifold times some fiducial J. And you want to prove the existence of a solution to this equation for this dilatational factor. Oh, I'll come back to this in a minute.
When you say Fu Yao can't be scaled arbitrarily with flux,
yeah.
Is there some obstacle they see in their constructions? Is there some reason why it fails? Or is this merely an example of, in fact, we have not proved the existence of these arbitrarily?
I bet there's a tadpole.
There are tadpoles. It boils down to this. This equation will be translated into certain topological invariants in the manifold. There are a bunch of integers in the construction corresponding to how many times a circle winds around some cycle in the geometry. Now, there's going to be a Diophantine equation, just an integer equation, relating those guys. And there are going to be finitely many solutions to that. And that just comes from some simple topology in the construction. Now, in the class of manifolds I'll be discussing, this is a special case. Okay, and we'll see that you can be a bit more general, particularly if you go to higher dimension. But even in total dimension 6, we'll still be able to tweak this a lot. But let me just talk about geometries of this as a target. We'd like to see Fu Yao coming out. Sort of a nice way to say it. So what's the full set of constraints for, let me just review the heterotic n equals 1 story and then go back to building linear models. So I want to emphasize these guys. Particularly this guy's graduating this year. Josh is really amazing. He's really great. So we're going to construct a heterotic compactification for some bundle over X, where X is just some six-dimensional manifold. This is just the heterotic gauge bundle. Okay. Requiring 40 n equals 1, in order to have 40 n equals 1, we need a spinner on this manifold that we can compactify the 10-dimensional spinner down to get a 4-dimensional manifold. And we're going to require that it's nowhere vanishing. This corresponds to having an SU3 structure. But the important thing is, out of this spinner, we can build things, we can build a bunch of bilinears, like gamma, mu, nu, eta. And if this is nowhere vanishing, this is nowhere vanishing. I can add on another index to get a 3 form. So the upshot from this is that you get, if you have n equals 1, i.e. if you have this nowhere vanishing spinner, your manifold X satisfies a bunch of conditions. It's complex. It has a Hermitian metric J. It has a nowhere vanishing 3 form, holomorphic 3 form. And it has a Hermitian Yang-Mills gauge field. Oops. Okay. So this is a lot of structure for the manifold. But no one said that this has to be vanishing, has to be covariantly constant with respect to the metric connection. You can prove that there's a connection, which comes under many different names. Let me just call it the connection. There's a connection which annihilates this spinner. Okay? And it always has the form delta is equal to delta G plus some field H, which has only 1, 2, and 2, 1 pieces. Okay? Now, if H is equal to 0, then delta G eta equals 0, which implies that dj equals 0. So we're Kähler. And this leads us to Clausius. In general, H is not equal to 0. So we don't have a covariantly constant spinner according to the Levi-Civita connection. We're not Kähler. In fact, the Kähler condition is replaced by D J wedge J, which is called the balanced condition. It's going to play relatively little role in what I talk about, except that this has an interesting structure on conformal Clausius. Maybe it's not so relevant. And it's not Kähler. And of course, it's thus not Clausius. Okay, so in the Fu Yao construction, I'm writing in the dark. Can everyone see this?
You can raise.
No,
I mean,
sweet, thank you.
Yeah, what are the trying to use? Like, if you wrote a superpotential that was H wedge omega,
good.
You stationarized, would you find the stationary points over H is type 1, 2, plus 2, 1?
Ah, so I don't know how to write. I'm not going to be able to describe any of this from the point of view of a superpotential,
okay.
Because crucially in these compactivications, we're going to find out that when this obtains, when there's intrinsic torsion, we're going to have to satisfy the Bianchi identity. And generically, that's going to lead us to non-trivially solving the Bianchi identity. And that's something we can't get from a superpotential upstairs in any simple way. So if there is a way, no one knows how to do it. Okay. So the full set of conditions that I'm going to get don't derive from a classical superpotential upstairs in reducing. Oh, sorry, upstairs here is 10 dimensions if I were doing 10 dimensional supergravity reduced.
So, but you're talking about the superpotential in the n equals 1 theory in 4
dimensions? Oh, sorry, yeah, absolutely. From the n equals 1 superpotential you get in 4D.
I mean, that's still packaging of it in terms of an n equals 1 effective supergravity. There must be, right?
Well, no. I mean, there must be some packaging in terms of n equals 1 supergravity with alpha prime corrections.
You mean higher derivative terms are going to matter? So the two derivatives.
Yeah, the higher derivative terms are going to matter crucially.
In the ten dimensions.
No, but
in the four dimensions, I thought the question was about the four dimensional effective.
Oh, pardon.
Supersymmetry theory. Yeah.
Right. If you wrote a deep class alpha in like superpotential H wedge omega.
Right.
I'm guessing since H is real, you'd actually find exactly the condition you said, that it's 2-1 plus 1-2.
Oh.
But I could be wrong.
I think that's entirely plausible.
Okay. I'm trying to find a sloppy way to think about it.
Yeah. Okay. This is very much not the way I think about it, so I'm sorry, I can't,
okay.
Can't give you a simple answer. Let me just say that we don't know how to get it from a superpotential. Good. Okay, so in the Fu Yao construction, they say, okay, look, let's start with a K3. Let's just take K3 because it's a nice thing. And we're going to pick two forms, omega I in H2 of K3. And we're going to require that they're in integer cohomology. And we're going to use them to build T2 bundles. So these are going to be, these two forms are going to be the curvatures on a couple of circle bundles. And we'll call the bundle X. So it's just T2 bundles over K3 with curvatures omega. So this gives a natural form for the metric on X, just on symmetry grounds, ds squared K3 plus d theta 1. Plus alpha 1 squared plus ditto 2, where d alpha I is equal to omega I. So this is just a local one form. So this is just the vertical direction along the fiber for everyone who thinks about things this way. So standard closed Klein form with some conformal factor. Okay. So this is what's compatible with symmetries. Now, they also need to turn on, because this is no longer going to be Kähler, they're going to need to turn on some torsion, which is going to be d theta I wedge omega I. So this is non-trivial in cohomology. This is non-trivial downstairs. This is non-trivial upstairs. Good. And you can write a Hermitian form for this whole manifold. So this manifold is manifestly Hermitian. And by taking theta 1 plus I theta 2 and d of this plus alpha 1 plus I alpha 2, I can build a vertical one form, which is a 0-1 form, so it's holomorphic. And the crucial thing is that I can build a nowhere vanishing holomorphic 3 form on X, which is equal to theta wedge, the holomorphic 3 form on K3. Okay, so this is manifestly has an n equals 1 structure, It's got a nowhere vanishing holomorphic 3 form, just like on a Calabi-Yau. It's got this particular metric onsets, which is just telling us that it's a couple of circle bundles over a K3. And it's got some H-flux turned on. And you can check that it's annoying but straightforward to check that this solves all of the supergravity equations, except the Bianchi identity, which I've wisely erased. So that's the one remaining thing that's difficult to show that it solves. And notice that the only free parameter here is U. We're saying start with K3, which means start with a particular choice of the Kähler form in K3 and complex structure, and build everything as we've shown. So the choices are these elements of integer cohomology and the Kähler form on K3, the geometry of K3, and we're left with this free function U. What Fu and Yao prove is that the Bianchi identity becomes a non-trivial PDE for this conformal factor for U. And they prove that there exists a unique solution. Okay, so this is a lot like the Yao proof of the Calabi conjecture. The analysis is in many ways related. It's these, you know, Harnack inequalities and then putting bounds on certain terms in the PDE and proving the existence of smooth solutions to those bounded PDEs. Now, this is an incredible feat of analysis, but as Shama was saying, it only tells us that there's a solution to this one loop equation. So a natural question is, can we extend this to a solution of the full supergravity equations?
And there's a finiteness criterion from what do you have to do the omegas here to make their theorem hold?
Oh, good. Okay, so for the omegas, we need the omegas need to be in H2, but they need to be 1-1 forms so that the 1-1 they're the integer cohomology exemplars of the 1-1 class. And the Bianchi identity, good, thanks, Sean. This is really important. The Bianchi identity reduces to a certain set of constraints on these integers. Okay, so the Bianchi identity reduces to a condition, which, what's the best way to write this out? I don't even think I have this written down. Good. It reduces to if I take these to be in the class N1, N2, then it becomes N1 squared plus N2 squared is equal to, I should be a little more careful about this, but this is going to be schematic. We'll see it in more detail later, and it'll be more transparent what the form is, of ch of tk3 minus ch2 of vk3. So one thing I've sort of suppressed here is that there's a vector bundle over k3, which we'll call v sub k3. We have a T2 vibration over this K3, so we induce a pullback bundle on X, which I'll call Vx. Okay, so the input is the K3 with some heterotic bundle over it, such that these two things fail to vanish. Okay, now they fail to vanish even in cohomology, and we set them equal to some integers, and this really represents some integer class in cohomology. Okay, some element of H4, because it's squared, and we require that this integer cohomology equation is satisfied, and that leads to a solution upstairs of that's necessary for the solution upstairs of this PDE, which is not in cohomology, which is a smooth PDE on the geometry. Okay, so this is the integrability condition.
And making your omegas type 1-1 fixes a lot of the K3.
That's right, exactly. And also of X, right? X, you could imagine, how, yeah.
So this is a special construction of solutions. The equation. Is there anything known about whether there are more general solutions?
There are definitely more general solutions. So one of the reasons, so with Calabi-Yau, there was a similar question, right? We have the Z manifold, you know, and how many solutions are there? Well, it's hard until you have a constructive. Sorry. One of the nice reasons to, or one of the useful features of a linear model description is that it's a very natural example generating machine. So we're going to generate a lot of examples later on. But here's a simple, that go beyond this K3 construction. So for example, you can do this in many dimensions. You can show that the conformal field theories exist. Here's a nice example, Delpezzos. You can take Delpezzos and fiber T2s over them and get a complex threefold. There's no Calabi-Yau in the game anywhere. It's completely non-Kähler at every step of the way. But you get a six-dimensional manifold, which is smooth, which is, you know, the vibration is non-degenerate. There's an n equals 1 structure. There's an SU3 structure on the resulting manifold. You can build seven-dimensional manifolds, which are seven manifolds times a circle, which have, again, special Lonmi G2 structure on the seven manifold. It's a trivial circle product. You can build eight-dimensional manifolds of this form. I mean, there's a wide variety of examples for this.
And do these all have simple F-theory duals because of the T2 structure?
Other than the K3 example, I don't know any F-theory duals for these. I'd hope that they would, because the T2 structure is nice. On the other hand, one thing we'll see, so at the level of Fu Yao, an interesting question is how much can you tweak this geometry? There's complex structure for this T2, can you tweak it? No, you can't. So we know this from the linear model, because there's just no moduli for it. You break supersymmetry if you do. So that has a legacy in the F-theory construction, too. Now, in general, in these manifolds, the T2 is going to be rigid. We're going to find surprising sort of constraints on this complex structure, even though we're really dealing with a Kähler structure.
Sometimes linear models don't actually capture all the
moduli. Absolutely. So for example, on a K3, you're never going to get all of the moduli, just because not all of them are algebraic at once.
Right.
Good.
So the fact you don't see them in a linear model.
Absolutely. On the other hand, that's very true. That's absolutely true. On the other hand, you can ask whether deforming, so when you do have that parameter in the linear model, you can ask whether or not the supersymmetry admits that deformation, even if it doesn't look natural in the linear model. You can also ask the more useful question, which is, what's the massless spectrum?
I mean, you see it in the linear model, but as an obstructed direction.
Yeah, absolutely, as an obstructed direction, right. So you can also more directly just ask, what's the massless spectrum, right? So, okay, good. Okay, so in particular, it's a sort of comment a little more on what Shoma was just saying. It's natural to expect that these have some sort of duals. And in particular, the Fu Yao is dual to a K3 cross K3 compactification of F-theory. It's by a chain of dualities related to a 2B compactification that actually Shoma at first played with a few years ago, which is a K3 cross T2 orientifold. So let me just say this a little bit about the dual of Fu Yao. The dual of Fu Yao is a 2B compactification on an orientifold of a sort of slightly degenerate Calabi-Yau, which has a bunch of singularities at which are localized O7 planes and D4 and D7 brains, and there's 5-form flux, which is built up out of 4-form flux, C2 wedge H3, you know, B2 wedge F3, and that's a compactification that you can check in supergravity exists at the level of supergravity. It's stabilized to a point where all of the moduli have values that are small enough that the analysis is self-consistent. Okay, so by duality, we end up with this construction, which, when the original manifold is actually at small volume, corresponds to a weakly coupled theory here. So we're going to have a microscopic description for that flux vacuum.
So some parameters are not frozen. And when you do duality, they let you run off the flux vacuum.
That's right. That's right. Some moduli in that story are not.
But if you were to succeed in a program of freezing all moduli, then you would be really up a creek, because you would have no duality. I mean, by definition, you would have no duality when you would go to find out that the thing was well.
It kind of depends on the type 2 side. Absolutely.
Any side, right? It wouldn't matter what duality I proposed.
We wouldn't worry about it. Exactly. I wouldn't.
Absolutely. But I mean, his goal was to sort of describe in world sheet terms.
My goal is to describe in world, to give a microscopic world sheet construction of flux vacua where moduli are lifted, what naively at a classical level look like moduli. So if we succeed in a heterotic context of completely lifting the moduli, which we don't here, but it, you know, if one could, then okay, yeah, we don't have a nice weakly coupled dual, but that's okay. We have a microscopic description of this isolated vacuum. So, you know, that would be a good thing in the first place.
It doesn't seem possible if you preserve low energy to break to stabilize all the moduli imperturbably.
Right, no. Yeah, absolutely. Standard story there. If I have time, I might mumble some words about stabilizing more moduli. Great, okay. Good, so with that, sorry, lengthy introduction, let me walk you through the gauge linear supermodel construction. And I'm going to do this in some slightly coarse detail, because it gets a little bit technical at some points. I don't want to bore you. So what we want is a compactification with H not equal to 0. And at the most superficial level, we want dB to not equal 0. We're also going to be interested in Chern-Simons terms. But for the moment, this is a step in the right direction. Oh, sorry, right. so, and in particular, these are going to be non-Kähler. So before getting to the full 0-2 construction, let's just start with 2-2 models, where we can already ask this question. NSNS flux is present in 2-2. We have more supersymmetry. It's more constrained. Let's think about this. So in a 2-2 gauge linear second model, we usually have a bunch of chiral fields. We have a bunch of gauge fields, VA. And let me call this just VA. And the chiral fields have charges QIA. Call this a capital I. Now, it's a well-known fact that every Kähler nonlinear sigma model built out of chiral fields is necessarily Kähler. So this is clearly not going to do the work for us. We're going to have to introduce some multiplet that's not chiral. So a natural thing to do is in 2-2 supersymmetry, we have twisted chiral fields. So chiral fields we have in 2-2, we have a right-moving bar, a left-moving, and a left-moving bar superderivative. A chiral field is annihilated by these two guys. A twisted chiral is annihilated by these two guys. Okay, and it's something that doesn't descend from a four-dimensional chiral field. So if I take a 4D n equals 1 theory, for those of you who aren't familiar with 2-2, if I take 4D n equals 1 and I reduce to two dimensions, I get an extra U1 from rotations in the plane on which I've reduced. Okay, so I now have two U1s that look like internal symmetries or R-symmetries of the super algebra. Okay, so that means I can have different charges. I can have the original chiral field, which is charged in the appropriate way under those two U1s, but I can flip the sign of the charge under one of the U1s. And that's just saying that the left-moving U1 is going to be charged differently. Okay. So this guy is transforming in a different supersymmetry multiple than this guy. This is a twisted chiral. This is a chiral. And we can imagine trying to build a theory with both of these guys. Now, we want a gauge theory because we want to use the supernormalizability to control computations. So we want to build a theory where these guys only interact via gauge interactions. But the gauging that we did here was a chiral field goes to e to the theta chiral field, where this is a chiral parameter. So we can't minimally couple both chirals and twisted chirals. So there would seem to be a no-go theorem for building gauge linear sigma models with interesting geometries built out of the two.
Sorry, in ordinary JLSMs, there are twisted chirals and the sigma, right?
Right, exactly. But they're good. They're not charged. So in the, right? Good. In fact, those are the gauge field strengths. That's right. So in fact, as usual with the no-go theorem, this tells us exactly where to go. So we want to add this in. As Eva just wisely pointed out, the gauge field strength, sigma, is a twisted chiral field. Oh, look, we can introduce a gauge coupling between these guys. So how are we going to do that? Well, where does B appear in a gauge linear sigma model? It appears in the twisted chiral superpotential in the form TA sigma A. Okay. Where the complexified Kähler class, so this is a geometry with some target space S, and if we build a complexified Kähler class on S, it's just TA, HA, where HA are two forms, one-to-one correspondence with the gauge field strengths. These are just the hyperplane classes on the ambient variety. And J is, of course, equal to J plus IB. So the imaginary part of little t of our FI parameter, the theta angles, are just giving us the B field.
Which two thetas are you integrating over
there? These are the twisted chiral. So this is
okay, so that's
D squared. Exactly. It's D theta plus D theta bar minus.
So
the HAs are the hyperplane classes on the target geometry.
What are they in terms of physical model?
So they're good. Okay, so
these are some twisted chiral fields that are.
So good. So sorry. These are in two different languages. So this is a statement in the gauge field theory. Okay. And these are the twisted chiral field strengths. The gauge field strengths. These map into the geometry as two forms. So there's a correspondence between these two guys. So this is a statement in the geometry on the target space. So here's the statement. I have some gauge theory. I'm going to work on the Higgs branch. I integrate out the gauge fields, and I get an effective Kähler metric on the target geometry. The target metric is of this form, where the H's are elements of H2 of the target geometry of the S.
Just to my correction. And do you really think
sort
of the corrections in the math between the pi, all those parameters, and the TEs?
Oh, they're a correction. They're of course corrections. Sorry, this is at the classical level. So this is just the theory is free in the UV. It's quadratic in the gauge fields. I integrate out the gauge fields, get the semi-classical theory. It's just like the lowest Born-Oppenheimer approximation of the geometry. But let's work with classical. So in a 2-2 theory, all the perturbative stuff blissfully goes away. Right. So for the purposes of moduli and topology, we don't have to worry about it.
You're getting Thomas's mannerisms.
God save me. H is very much, yeah. H is very much the hero of the story. So the B field shows up in the imaginary parts of T. Okay? So TA are equal to RA, the more familiar real FI parameter, plus I theta A. So here in a standard geometry, so let's say we haven't turned on the twisted carols yet, just some stupid 2-2 gauge linear sig model as usual, then the B field is equal to theta A, which is just the coefficient of the twisted carol superpotential times HA. So DB is zero, because this is in cohomology, and this is a constant. Aha! How do we get H? Well, let's make theta not constant. That seems like a good idea. So if theta is now promoted to a dynamical field, then DB is not equal to zero. DB is equal to D theta wedge H, which is interesting and non-trivial. So, hey. Okay. If you're annoyed by the notation HA and H, I think blame David, but is this is notation due to you, or?
I don't know.
Okay. I learned it by watching you, if anyone knows that ad.
No, R is also dynamical.
Oh, crap, exactly. So N equals 2 requires that you can't just promote the imaginary part dynamically. You have to promote the whole thing to dynamical. So we don't have just a circle. We have a whole C star, because this is R plus I theta, so it's not a complex valued thing. It's a C star valued thing. So what's our theory now? Our theory started out with S, some geometry S, and we're in 2-2. We just have some target space S.
And so T is a chiral multiple
for a twisted chiral. It's a twisted chiral. Aha. So how have we evaded the no-go theorem? We've evaded the no-go theorem because we haven't minimally coupled Y. We've axially coupled Y. We're going to replace T by some dynamical fields YL with some coefficients NLA. And for single-valuedness of the action, we need these to be integers if these have period 2 pi. Their imaginary parts. Okay, well, H is in cohomology.
Yes.
And I want DB to be not zero. So.
Oh, good. Okay.
Good. So that it's a target space statement.
Yeah, good.
Okay. Good. So we started with our target S, and we wanted to turn on H flux. And we did a very clever thing. We turned on an axial coupling, except we didn't. We failed. We failed miserably. We've actually built a C star vibration, which I'll call X tilde, over S. Okay? Because we added some target space coordinates. We promoted the FI parameters to new dynamical fields. So we didn't succeed in turning on flux on S. We turned on flux on something built out of S, where we built some fiber bundle over S.
You just make S one less dimensional than you thought, though.
Well, that's a fun thing to do, but we could have taken S to be K3, right? In which case, this is now a three complex dimensional manifold. Okay, that would be great. You could also take S to be a Calabi-Yau threefold, and so this is a four-dimensional manifold. In general, we could take M of these FI parameters to be dynamical, and we'd have a C star to the M vibration. Okay?
Sorry, well, why aren't these dimensions just eaten up by the fact that theta has to solve some equation of motion because B is really fixed by the non-trivial choice of H?
Sorry?
I'm a little confused about why you actually get an extra two dimensions.
Good. So let's take this model. We have N chirals. We have S gauge fields. So we have N minus S dimensional target space.
Sure.
We're now adding L twisted chirals.
There already was a constraint from that. That was the future constraint, right?
Yeah. So we have an N equals 2 quotient. We have a Kähler quotient.
Oh, I see. You're just modifying the D term.
I'm modifying the D term. Exactly. We're not adding any gauge fields. We're just adding target space directions. Okay.
Okay. I will admit I introduced HA.
Yes.
However, that was partly because I was ignorant of the existence of H, which is a silly notation.
Whoo. We're gonna have to step outside after this.
Who introduced an S?
Probably Schwartz.
Okay. So this is fine. We've got a C star vibration. That's a reasonable state of affairs. We haven't done anything too horrible.
So the H flux lives where on the geometry?
The H flux, good, excellent. So the H flux this has a bunch of coordinates r, l, plus I, theta, l, okay, on the C-star fibers. S has a bunch of coordinates, and in particular, it has these elements of cohomology, HA. And on X, we have H on X is equal to d theta L n L a H a with a wedge in here. And if you don't believe me, it's easy enough to write down this linear model, integrate out the massive vector, and check that you get a Hermitian manifold with this structure, yada, yada. Yes. This H lives here, or H on X lives here, and H sub A lives down.
If that was the early evidence
of this
duality.
Okay, so. That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right.
So you can't doubt if there's a chiral superpotential, like rearrange how it depends on these things.
No, that's exactly right. But you couldn't do it for a lot of reasons. You couldn't do it because how could you write a twisted chiral superpotential that's gate exactly. Yeah. So that's a.
Well, you could add a twisted chiral P.
You could add a twisted chiral P, but it'd be a shift charge thing. I'll come back to that in a minute. Okay. I'll come back to that in a minute. So.
I'm sorry, but we're still working with U1 here, or we promoted the gauge group?
U1. Everything is U1. I haven't touched the gauge group. The gauge group is exactly.
These are just singlets.
These Ys are just singlets. They're just completely. I can't couple them minimally. They can only be coupled axially.
What do you mean by coupling them minimally? They're not charged.
That's what I mean. Yeah. They don't have standard gauge coupling. They're not gauge charged.
They're coupled to F
axially.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So in general, we can more or less do what Shamit just said. So first off, I want to point out that this has a local product structure, which is C star to the M local product with S. Okay, so locally, it looks just like fiber times base. Okay, globally, it doesn't have that structure. This is hallmark of H flux in a 2-2 model from non-logistic models from Gates-Hull row check. In general, we could do the following. We could write down a Lagrangian, which is of the form some Lagrangian for a target space geometry, call it V, built out of a bunch of chirals and a twisted chiral gauge field strength, plus, this is just standard story, plus L for some W built out of twisted chirals and a chiral gauge field strength, okay? Plus, now we can add superpotential couplings, integral d squared theta tilde sigma g of y, if g is a sufficiently well-behaved function, plus integral d squared theta s f of phi. Okay? Now you can just check that if at the end of the day the thing is conformal, which just means it's a 2-2 model, so that's exactly the statement that the R current is non-anomalous, both R currents are non-anomalous. Conformal, then we have a local structure which is V times W. These are both Kähler manifolds. Globally it's not Kähler. Globally it has H flux turned on. But it's non-compact. No matter what you do, you can't build a model in this fashion that's compact and flat. Okay? So this is a familiar no-go theorem from supergravity. If you turn on NS flux and you don't turn on anything else, the only way to cancel the tadpoles is to make the volumes infinite. Okay, so it's the familiar statement. Now, I'm not going to talk about this now, but you can do the same thing generalizing with semi-chiral multiplets, which are only annihilated by one of the four superderivatives, and build out of the semi-chirals chiral or twisted chiral currents, and couple those to the standard 2-2 gauge multiplet. This gives you a much broader class of models. In particular, you can then build compact, interesting geometries that are WZW models. But let me leave that aside because it's sort of tangential to what I'm interested in for the 2-2 or for the 0-2 story. Questions?
You said that what you've built up so far is not sufficient to make a compact model. That's the
right. Absolutely. Yeah.
How much world sheet supersymmetry did you have from the semi-parable?
2-2. 2-2, entirely 2-2. Okay. The interesting case, the really interesting case are the 1-2 semichiral models. I don't really understand those very well. But, you know, let me leave that aside for the moment. We can talk about it a bit later if you want. So, quick note in case anyone's worried. You'll notice that we've got, we took S and we said, okay, there's its moduli space, some of its moduli anyway, which are these Fi parameters, and we've promoted these to directions in the target, which are labeled by these YLs. And in particular, the point R equals theta equals 0 is on this moduli space. It's a little C star. So there's this point here where S is singular, right? And in fact, the CFT is singular at that point. So you might say, you know, that this is a very bad thing to do because the total space must have this gnawing, horrible singularity. So for example, say I took the conifold where the defining function is f is equal to x, y, minus z, w, minus t, where t is the fi parameter, it's just the small resolution. Okay, t equals 0, this thing is singular. But notice as a three manifold, it's singular. But since dtf is equal to minus 1, as a 4 manifold, it's smooth. And this is a generic feature here. Since the axial couplings are linear, we're always going to have this structure. And these geometries will always be smooth. Okay? If you just compute the metric, you have to be very careful about this. But suffice it to say that they're smooth. Sort of a technical point. Okay. So this is good for our 2-2 models. We'd like to do it in the 0-2 models. How does the story change? Well, so far it hasn't really been all that interesting. We haven't discovered anything new. We've turned on axial couplings, and we found that that gave us some H field. But we haven't seen the Bianchi identity. Everything's non-compact. We haven't made contact with geometry that we really care about that'll give us lifted moduli and interesting phenomenology. I should say that I'm not going to make any direct contact with interesting phenomenology here, so all important caveats. So what we'd like, though, is we'd like to start moving in the right direction, and we want H not equal to 0 in a non-compact 0-2 model. So again, we're going to start with some manifold S, but now we have left-moving fermions, and we're going to turn on VS over S. So again, 0-2 model, the left-moving fermions coupled to this vector bundle, the right-moving structure is in S. So let me say that differently. The chiral multiplets in a 0-2 model, this is maybe not so familiar, plus theta plus psi plus. So we have standard n equals 2 story. The fermions, super partners of the scalars, are going to transform as tangent vectors to the space coordinatized by the phis. So the right movers are going to transform as sections of TS. For the left movers, they're in a totally separate multiplet. Gamma is equal to minus m. M is a little index, minus its remainder, it's left moving, gamma minus m plus theta plus fm, where fm is an auxiliary field. So this has, together, these have the field content of an of a 2-2 chiral multiplet. We have left and right moving super fermions, an auxiliary field and a scalar. However, this is an auxiliary field coupled to the left movers. These guys transform in different super multiplets. What that means is they can have different gauge charges, they can interact differently in the theory. That's going to be crucial for us. And in particular, these guys transform as sections of the bundle, whereas these guys transform as sections of the tangible. So again, as in the 2-2 case, we have the complexified Kähler class of the target spaces of the form TAHA. So BA, or B is of the form theta A, HA, and H is equal to 0 again. So what are we going to do? We're going to promote the FI parameters to dynamical fields again. This is exactly as we did before. But the story is somewhat different because these FI parameters show up in a simple superpotential, TA. So this is the field strength, epsilon A, which is a fermionic multiplet. The crucial thing here is that in 0-2, there are no twisted chirals. There's no left-moving supersymmetry. So how could you have known how it behaved under the left-moving supersymmetries? We just have the right-moving supersymmetry. So these complexified FI parameters, which I'm now going to promote as YL with the coupling M, what do I want to call it, MNLA, these guys are now chiral, which means they transform in the same multiplets as the scalars on S, which are coupled to the gauge field. So first off, when we do this, we ended up with C star to the M, where we promoted M of these. C star to the M bundle over S with a bundle of VS, and it gets pulled back to a bundle over V over X tilde. Okay, two problems with this model: non-compact and Bianchi identity just nowhere in sight, play no role. So I'm going to leave non-compact aside for the moment. We'll come back to it. The interesting bit is the Bianchi identity. So why did we take the 2 to 0 in the first place? Why are we working with the 0-2 model versus the 2-2 model? Well, the basic story is the left movers and the right movers transform in different representations. Right? So we have left movers coupling to a different bundle than the right movers. Before I get to that, let me come back to this point. So We start off with, so when we promote the FI parameters to dynamical fields, they're chiral now instead of being twisted chirals. We can charge them under the gauge group. Okay? So now I'm going to change the kinetic term so that they're canonically coupled to the gauge field, so that y under a gauge transformation goes to y minus I m, so LLA lambda a, where lambda is the gauge parameter. Okay? So I'm allowed to do this. I can. It's compatible with gauge symmetry and super, except for one thing. This is no longer a gauge invariant. So the axial coupling transforms into itself plus integral d theta plus minus I m l a lambda a epsilon b n l b. Okay, this is not zero. So crap, it looks like this is a totally useless model. Except, since the left and the right movers transform in different representations of the gauge group, there can be a one-loop anomaly from the fermions. So what is the one-loop anomaly in these models? Aha. Well, the one-loop anomaly, first off, anyone who's worked with 0-2 models will know this, but I'm going to repeat it. It's not terribly well presented in the literature. But the anomaly in two dimensions is a familiar diagram. You know, if we were in three dimensions, we'd add an extra leg. So here's VA and VB, where these are the vectors. And they get contributions, as usual. So this is proportional to contribution from the right movers, which is their charge QI, QI, AB from the two vertices, minus a sum from the left movers, which I'll call lowercase QM, A, QM, B. Okay. Let me call this A, AB, this little matrix in the gauge indices. So said differently, the partition function, or rather the measure, D of the fields, goes to D of the fields times E to the minus, I'm going to put an 8 pi in here just for fun, P theta plus. A, AB, lambda A, epsilon, B. Okay, just standard gauge anomaly. Now, since the right movers couple to the tangent bundle and the left movers couple to this vector bundle, we can also write geometrically that there's a four form in the target space, A, which is equal to A, AB, HA, wedge, HB, which I can write as CH2 of the target space tangent bundle minus CH2 of the vector bundle S. Okay. So in a usual 0-2 model, what we do is we work hard with the gauge charges to make sure this is 0. And if the gauge anomaly is 0, then A, then that tells us that the CH2, the second churn anomaly, of the nonlinear sigma model is zero, because it's just this. There may be additional components which don't reduce, but those are kind of anomalous cases, and let me leave that aside. For a generic example, this is sufficient. So usually we set this equal to zero. We don't have to. So this is the basic strategy. It's a 2D Green-Schwarz mechanism. We're going to build this H-flux on a bundle over S. So this was M, A, L, N, L, B, lambda A, epsilon, B. We build this H-flux on this vibration over S, where S and V have an anomaly. Okay? We then use these fiber directions as axions, as charged axions in a Green-Schwarz mechanism, cancel the anomaly of the underlying theory. This allows us, if you check upstairs, exactly solves the Bianchi identity upstairs. In fact, it precisely reproduces in the Fu Yao case the constraint that Fu and Yao get. Well, I glossed over one important thing. Here, in the Fu Yao case, I had something that looked like n1 squared plus n2 squared. I had a T2 bundle. So first off, we have a C star bundle, not a T2 bundle, so it looks non-compact. Secondly, it looked like we had n1 squared plus n2 squared, whereas from our construction, we're getting this mn plus mn, 1, 1, 2, 2, this doesn't look the same. What's the deal? Why do I have more integers free than in the Fuyao case? Okay, I'll come back to that in a second. But first, let me just emphasize that at this level, if we choose a solution of, if we choose M L A N L A is equal to A, sorry, B, is equal to A, AB, any solution to this integer equation corresponds to a non-anomalous 0-2 gauge theory, which flows to a conformal field theory. I'll talk about instantons later, but so this is just the anomaly condition.
Question?
Yeah.
If C1 of TS and C1 of B are non-zero, does anything terrible happen?
No.
Nothing happens.
So crucial things that we have that I haven't mentioned, there are more anomalies than just a gauge anomaly, right? You've got all sorts of global anomalies. You've got to make sure that you have a chiral GSO for supersymmetry in space-time. You have, you know, anomalies in various R currents. You want to make sure that the D terms aren't running. 0-2 models are very easy in this regard. You can add spectators to cancel running of the FI parameters. You know, it's a very unconstrained system.
Right.
Absolutely. So
that was one of the criteria.
Exactly. So you definitely, you need a left moving U1, you need a right moving U1, you need to make sure that you have all these, but that's not a problem because you can choose the currents or the charges separately for left and right movers. So while it's true that you still have those constraints, mm-hmm. they're very simple to satisfy.
You're saying that the geometric description of them is not that C1 has to be 0.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
But there is some condition.
There is some condition. It has to do with a bunch of, so for example,
but what is it in the geometry?
Okay, it's not in the geometry. That's the crucial statement. So, for example, here's a statement in 0-2 theory. In a 0-2 theory, say I have some non-anomalous 0-2 theory, but the scalar charges don't sum to 0. So it looks like I have running of the FI parameter, even though C1 is equal to 0 of the target geometry. I can fix that by adding spectators. I add some scalar field and some fermion, which have opposite gauge charges, so I can turn on this superpotential, MS gamma. Okay. Now, I can choose their R charges so that they contribute to the R anomaly and cancel the R anomaly. Or alternatively, I can choose them. This scalar is also contributing to the running of the FI parameter. So I can choose the charges to cancel the running of the FI parameter. But it's in the massive sector of the theory. So at the level of the massless theory, you don't see it.
You're saying there's just always a new one?
Yeah. It's not always, but it's the constraints are very, very weak.
But you're essentially saying that if you're saying that you
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's not always true that there are solutions to the integer equations such that you can find massive. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. But modulo details like that. Okay, so what have we done so far? So we have this construction, but it's not compact. Okay, so what do we do? What's the natural thing to do? Well, the natural thing to do is, what's the non-compact direction? Well, YL is equal to RL plus I theta L. This we want to keep, this we want to lose. So why not just drop the Rs? Well, N equals 2 is manifestly broken if we drop the R's. N equals 2 requires that all the scalars are complex. So this looks like a bit of a disaster. Except, note that we can do something reminiscent of Fuyao. Whoops. Wow. So say we take N equals 2. So we have C star squared. Okay, so we're going to take two axions Y. This has an alternate choice of complex structure, which is C cross T2. Where this is R1 plus I R2, and this is theta1 plus I theta2. Okay, so, aha, it looks like we can just rewrite the complex structure, and remember, to every N equals 2 corresponds a choice of complex structure in the nonlinear sigma model. So it looks like we can just rewrite this as a multiplet and drop it, right? Oh, we can't, though. That's way too easy, because it's incompatible with the N equals 2 gauging. The N equals 2 quotient structure requires that both of these are present. The D term is related to the U1 gauging by supersymmetry. Okay, so we have to work a little harder. And it's going to be connected to this MN versus just N squared detail. So let's see that come out. So I'm going to write down the Lagrangian, and it should clarify things. So the Lagrangian is the Lagrangian for S and VS that we started with before we added the extra axions. Plus, we have the kinetic terms for the various fields. We now have D theta L plus M L A V A squared plus D R L squared plus chi D minus chi L L fermionic superpartners. But multiplying them is some coefficient which we haven't fixed yet, K L squared. We can just add this. It doesn't do anything to the theory. It's just some coefficient. This is sort of the radius of the C star of the T2. Okay. Plus we have the axial coupling, plus 2NLA theta L V. Whoops, it's not a V. That's a V. Plus minus the gauge field strength A. This is the axial coupling. I'm just working everything out in components. Plus, now here's where we really fall apart, 2KL squared MLA minus NLA RADA plus 2, and there should be an I. It's not a 2, it's an I over a 2. Well, I don't know why I'm bothering with the I over root 2. Lambda A, some sort of pathology. Okay, so here's what's a disaster about this. What we want to do is remove the R's, R1 plus IR2. That means removing some of the chi's, okay, the real parts of the chi fields as well. They're super partners because we have to do this in an N equals 2 covariant fashion. Unfortunately, under a super variation, del lambda is equal to sigma times dA plus I V plus minus A. So under this variation, even from the imaginary parts that we want to keep, from the variation width of the gaugino, we pick up a term that looks like D times chi. But that D times chi is going to come from varying R against D. So if we drop this term, we have to keep the imaginary couplings, the couplings of the imaginary part of the fermions in Y against the gauginos. That's an important coupling in a gauge theory for N equals 2. But we don't have this term whose variation cancels the variation of this term. So it looks like we're toast. We just can't drop R D. So we drop the whole term. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're now going to fix that annoying coefficient K, which is the radius of the fiber, by setting 2 KL squared MLA is equal to NLA. These are fixed in terms of the curvature of the bundle, or sorry, the choice of H-flux and the curvature of the bundle, which in particular they're integers, which means K is fixed to a particular quadratic irrational, and K squared is fixed irrational. It's discretely fixed. So we see that those moduli are fixed. And you can check that the rest of the Lagrangian is invariant under an additional 0,2 only at this particular value. So for this value, for this choice of charges, we have a T2 vibration X over S, again with our H flux turned on, the Bianchi identity satisfied as usual, times a totally decoupled C. This theory, this C, the R fields, completely decoupled from the theory at this point.
I'm sorry, I missed why KL squared has to be chosen that one?
Well, it doesn't have to be chosen. It could be chosen to be some other value. If it were chosen to be some other value, the radial modes don't decouple from the...
Right.
So to get a compact model... Okay, so we started out, so we started out in a sort of long, drawn-out way to get to this non-compact model and then work hard to remove it. We could have just started with this. We just didn't know that we could have started with this. So we start with this. It's a compact model. The gauge theory is perfectly well behaved.
If you just start with that, how do you write the coupling of the fiber multiplying the field so that you get both multiplying the field strength and nothing multiplying D?
It's good. There's no simple way to write it in superspace. So you can write it in superspace in a way that, you know, looks like a good superspace. But crucially, this is not a chiral field. So let me say it differently. I could have taken the coordinates theta 1 and theta 2 and the imaginary parts of chi 1 and the imaginary parts of chi 2, and I could have built what looks like a good superfield, theta chiral superfield, theta 1 plus I theta 2 plus, in a horrible bastardization of notation, theta plus chi I 1 minus I chi I 2. And I could have said, oh look, this is the field content of a chiral field. Except it's not the field content of a chiral field, because these guys are both gauge charged, which is not the structure of an N equals 2 gauging of a chiral field. In fact, if you take this multiplet, it's impossible to write down a gauge invariant action for it. But we didn't want a gauge invariant action for it. So you can write down the chiral field, and you can write down the axial coupling to this guy. It's not chiral, but it cancels under a gauge transformation. Okay, so a lot of this is more transparent if you don't work in Wesimino gauge, which I've been working in throughout, because you know, you've got the anomaly, and so it's Suzy at variations only close up to a gauge transformation, which takes you back to Wesimino, blah, blah, blah. But if you're careful about all this, which we're very careful, Wow, that was a really worrying statement. If you're careful about all these details, in fact, you can write down a complete anchor system. It's easiest to see just working in components.
You're balancing the classical difference, the one-loop anomaly, which is another way of seeing what
you see. Exactly. It's a one-loop, it's a Green-Schwarz mechanism in 2D. There's the one-loop anomaly canceling the classical non-engaging string scale. That's why you end up with string scale. So I've suppressed all the alpha primes here, but if you're honest about the measure and the act of the action, then in fact there's an alpha prime that's floating around. So I've just dropped that.
Is there a way to think about this as H plus balance against some positive curvature of this non-Hilbert manifold? I mean, it's some version of a WDW-like model embedded,
I'm not sure.
I mean, because, the H plus is positive energy density, whatever.
Yeah,
so
yeah. The equation that I wrote down for you. Oh, so first off, let me just say that quickly, since we fixed n, we can just take k to be 2 and fix m and l related to each other. So this becomes effectively n squared. But anyway, leaving that aside, this equation, the balancing of the anomalies, when you reduce to four-dimensional supergravity, has an interpretation as a bunch of energy densities. So that statement, there is an energy balancing there. It's a little more complicated though, because these integers actually show up in a bunch of places. They show up in the solution. Where did it? It's not written down. The conformal factor has the integers in it as well. So
I guess it doesn't have to be right there because you have the alpha prime effects in here. So
it's the alpha prime effects that are canceling it out.
Well, it could be either, right? How do you know?
I think you can phrase it in both ways.
You're saying because of what we said a minute ago, it's not just the positive curvature classically.
That's right. That's right. So there's a contribution that comes from the classical curvature. There's a contribution that comes from the quantum effects, the alpha prime effects.
Well, you could write down a 10D action with F squared and R squared. And, this is a question of whether it's F or R.
Well, he's finding a solution
that's
string scale, so he has all the alpha prime effects.
Exactly.
My solution may not be valid, but I'm just asking. Classically, the H plus is positive energy density or something
like
that.
Yeah, so is F squared.
At the one loop model, this is Andy's solution. So you want the supergravity solution with the balance of forces.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Well, but I'm confused about there's some balancing of leading order and alpha prime against next order.
Right, and I'm not sure if there's a simple energetic way to phrase that, which is, I think, what you were asking.
Well, there ought to be, because there's a 10D action you can write down that includes F squared and R squared.
Mm-hmm.
And you could try to analyze that, and I presume F squared just gives positive.
There's H.
The F is the gauge.
The Hermitian gauge field.
So presumably that, one might guess that can't do it.
Right, so it's going to be balanced against some curvature contribution.
Right.
Yeah, possibly
right.
The R squared.
But why?
In fact, let me make that a little more sharp. You can build examples of this where the bundle's trivial.
Okay, then it's just H against
R.
But why are you guys saying that it couldn't be some alpha prime effect? Because he's at.
In fact, it
has to be alpha prime effects.
Yeah, but you can write down an effective supergravity action with the alpha prime effects.
With all of them? I mean,
just the lead. Well.
Yeah, but why are we talking about just the leading ones? Right. Is that,
the conditions you exhibited actually come from an action that Andy wrote down 17 years ago.
Right, exactly. Let me make a stronger statement and sort of sidestep this for a second, which is these conditions show up in the gauge theory as well-definedness of the partition function. My interest is in the existence of a conformal field theory. There's a one-loop approximation which has a supergravity description, which is not valid, but which is a good eyeball guess.
But it's a guide, as you said.
It's a guide.
But it is not a well-defined approximation
scheme. Absolutely.
Do you know the world sheet that Centons don't destroy?
Good, excellent. Okay, good. So this was, I've gone very slowly, so I'm sorry if I'm running way over. So actually, how badly am I running over?
It's not 20 minutes.
I'm really sorry. So let me wrap up very quickly. You can say a lot about these models. You can build other examples. For world seed instantons, let me point out two important facts. The first is we've got the instantons that lived in S in the first place. So all these world seed instantons are there, world seed instantons into K3. Now, if we look at the super variations of how do we find a BPS instanton? We look at the fermions and we require the vanishing of the Fermi actions, and we non-trivial solution that has vanishing action. If you look at the variation del of chi, which is the superpartner of the axion, this gives us an equation which is d plus theta plus v plus. Okay. Now, if I have an instanton background, v is not singly value is not via singular. That means d theta is singular. You back this out, the action is singular. So there's no finite action instanton where the instanton lies in a direction in the gauge group along which theta is charged. Okay? So we seem to have lost those instantons as finite action instantons. So what's going on? Well, this is actually a relatively familiar fact. If we have, say we have this bundle, this S1 bundle, or one of the T2 bundles, x over k3, where the curvature is omega. Okay. Now, as I mentioned, there's a vertical vector, which is d theta plus alpha, vertical form. This annihilates horizontal vectors, so this is purely vertical. So it's just the fiber directions, the one form along the fiber. Now, d of this, in the total space x, this is just d of d theta, which is 0, but d alpha is equal to omega. So that means the curvature form, which was a non-trivial in cohomology on K3, is d of a globally well-defined vertical form on this vibration. And it's well-defined because at every point there's a fiber direction. So it's unambiguous. It's a globally defined one form. That means that in x, omega is trivial. What that tells you is that the cycle corresponding to omega is not a trivial is trivial in homology, which means I can't non-trivially wrap a world sheet around it. Okay. So okay, I get no finite action BPS instanton. So those are compatible. So that tells us, so what instantons did we have? We had instantons along this direction in the gauge group and instantons in other directions. The instantons in the other directions were just instantons that didn't know about the vibration at all, and they just live in the K3 bundle. These are the completely familiar gauge theory instantons. The moduli space is compact. You can analyze them using techniques that Even and Witten studied, or Beasley and Witten more recently with a rather beautiful residue theorem. The analysis of Beasley and Witten doesn't exactly apply because our action is not gauge invariant, so you have to do the anomaly analysis a little bit differently to get Fermi zero mode, blah, blah, blah. But the instanton moduli space is compact. That's what we need. The gauge theory gives that to us.
The argument for that was there aren't any, there's put out these poles and there aren't any.
Right.
So here.
Same thing. Yeah. Okay. That's pretty much the key important point. Let me just close by saying that, let me add one for the point. You can compute everything you want in here. You can compute the H flux exactly at one loop, you can compute the H flux at one loop, you can compute the metric, check that it's Hermitian, check that H has the right forms, check that it solves the supergravity equation, check the Chern-Simons forms and make sure they show up in the effective nonlinear sigma models. They're there, works out like a champ. One thing we'd like to do, which we haven't done, is compute exact spectra. So, it's just a hard thing, and we just haven't gotten around to doing it.
So, what you say things like the number of generations is just such and such topological class, or
right? Exactly. So, I off the top of my head, no, I can't. So, but these are the short. I mean, there's a chiral sector of the theory. There's a topological description. You know, it's the tools that you guys used to apply. So, this is the sort of what we've been studying so far. The general cases, we haven't gone to specific examples. There are a bunch of cases to be studied here. As we said earlier, we don't need C1 equals 0, so that really opens up the space of possibilities. You know, the Euler character is unconstrained. We don't have the usual relations between B and H because we don't have the Hodge theoretic description at all. Is there special geometry in the moduli space of these things? I don't know. I mean, there's no hard Lefschetz theorem. There's probably nothing like that, but there's an awful lot of structure. There's a nowhere vanishing three form, blah, blah, blah. So I guess in sum, this is at least one class of flux vacua and heterotic string theory, which you can really control from the world sheet perspective, and where you have a constructive description that gives you a mechanism for building examples and computing what you want, Yukawas, everything else. So I think this is a well-motivated place to study. Thanks.